Well, in the art department, you have an enormous burden of physical problems, of course. The ordering of materials, hiring of models, supervision of a man who is our maintenance kind of person. A very big problem in the hiring of student assistants for some, and graduate students to teach some of the freshman drawing classes. Relationships between the faculty and freshman teachers. It's a big, big task. Now, this was the problem that we ran into. You found that letter where Grilly and Lilly and some of the others wanted me to come back from England, wasn't
right.
it?
And
to be
mid-60s.
Chairman again.
Right.
And in fact, they were at that time urging me to consider some possibility of being a more or less permanent chairman, because chairman, of course, by law, are elected every year.
Right.
And that had been one of my points, that to be chairman, you every year your head is on the line, and meanwhile you are not making any progress with perhaps your own academic betterment in terms of whatever research you're doing, or painting, or artwork, or whatever it may be. And so that was why they were trying to see if they couldn't manage that sort of a thing. There are a few departments that do that.
Mm.
Well, I had had a certain amount of freedom for a year or so, and I just didn't care all that much at the time. Sometimes I wish I had done it. But it is a difficult problem, and therefore, since I was chairman, I don't think anybody has stayed longer than 3 years. Many of them only two.
Mm-hmm.
That causes a discontinuity that's a problem.
Can you give an example of what you mean by discontinuity?
Well, yes. Some of the sheer mechanics change all the time. Registration. Registration is a difficult thing in the art department. But it doesn't need to be as difficult as it has become. I suspect that Hamilton has done better with it than most others. But 9 times out of 10, it's utter chaos, because the chairman hasn't been around long enough to grab hold, doesn't feel terribly concerned about getting it organized, because he just about get it organized before he decides that he's through with it, so it just lets it drag.
Mm-hmm.
There are many things that are just not done very well, because nobody even tackles the problem. If I wait long enough, it'll go away, and besides, I'm not going to be here forever.
Mm-hmm. To your knowledge, has that ever brought up a situation where you lost students, or had problems with students, or had problems with faculty difficulties because of the fact that there's less continuity?
Well, it does one thing that I don't like at all. It makes there has grown up, even in the undergraduate area, a problem where a student who reaches the junior year may find it quite difficult to enroll in certain classes. Now, it seems to me that any student who is a candidate for a bachelor's degree should be able to enroll in any class that they want to take, for which they have met the requirements, if they are careful to be among the first to register for that class.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, a great many of the faculty has little private cliques of people who quickly fill up a class. And then a person who has been looking forward very strongly to taking that work, but who hasn't in one way and another made an impression on that faculty member, is out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I was chairman, registration was first come, first serve, in the order in which they were supposed to register. Seniors first, juniors second, so on down the line. And nobody keeps lists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very important democratic procedure in a university.
I would guess.
It's a vicious thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would guess just offhand that when you do that kind of thing, that students who are left out sometimes then would, the problem generated there would tend to cause a little bit of conflict between different faculty members over whether or not a student of theirs or whatnot got in. Does that happen? Or?
Well, often it is, this is the problem, it is often those students who have not been terribly aggressive and those students who, put it bluntly, haven't shown themselves as being unusually competent.
Mm-hmm.
But the point that I make, and it's a very important point, is that some people are very quick to develop and other people develop very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen our students come in, especially the students who have the high IQ records, who may not really begin to blossom forth as unusually competent and interesting people in the arts until they are seniors or even into graduate school. Now, they need those classes.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they haven't just taken hold and responded very, very quickly doesn't necessarily mean that they can't. We had, when Al Sessler was still living, he died in 65, Sessler was one of those people whom the faculty used to laugh at. They used to call him the Dean of Women. But Sessler was one of those teachers who could find people who are struggling, but who are bright.
Hmm.
And he would work with those people in a very helpful way, so that suddenly somebody whom all the rest had said, well, he's bright, but he has no feel for the arts, Sessler would get them moving.
Mm-hmm.
Now, more people can teach that way, if they will teach that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's harder work.
Sure.
It's easier to teach somebody who responds immediately and easily to your way of doing things. Well, this is one problem that I have never approved of, and it starts in administration. The fact that it's possible is because somebody makes it possible.
That is, you don't believe that, for instance, I imagine that a lot of people in your faculty have had some sort of education courses somewhere in their career on, you know, methods and that kind of thing, or at least.
I would imagine that very much less than half of them nowadays have had any such background at all.
Less than what used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Because you seem to be saying that the reason that they deal with students in the way they do is due mainly to the administration's policy.
The permissiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that it takes work to make, for instance, a registration procedure which simply and flatly says to the faculty, this is the way we must do it. We have got to be fair to every individual that comes in to register. Somebody has to say that, and then somebody has to have enough understanding of how to organize lists, office procedures, and people to make that inevitable.
Mm. Now, when you had graduate students coming into your department in the time when you were chairman, and you, as you say, you try to take a balanced perspective of mm-hmm. their credentials, did you?
No, I didn't. The graduate committee did.
Okay.
However, again, I was chairman of the graduate committee, and I presented this material to them and emphasized all three factors.
Right. Now,
that is not now being done.
Right. The question would be for me then, has the sort of rejection rate of students or the failure rate of students who enter graduate studies then been any way different because of the fact that the procedure now is to take people who are proficient in their artwork, but not necessarily other ways. Has there been, you know, disappointments or so on that are of different nature now?
Well, I don't know that, and I don't know it for another very good reason. I believe that there has been a very much more flexible attitude taken toward requiring, for instance, art history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the MFA, as we originally set it up, and as long as I was chairman, it stayed that way, called for a student to have at least 4 courses, one a semester, in advanced art history. Now, I know that some of the studio people didn't like that. My feeling has been that since most of the MFA people hope one day to teach college, they should have at least that kind of background in art history. Now, I have a suspicion that that is either very loosely observed today or that it has even been canceled out.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's a very strong emphasis on the studio work this individual cares to do, and almost nothing else. There used to be a strong emphasis on a semester seminar every year, every semester, a seminar which involved at least some written paperwork. Again, for the reason which seemed to me valid, and seemed at that time to the faculty to be valid, that these people will be teaching college, or want to, and should therefore be able to do a simple research paper and some decent writing. Now, those things have become very much less important in the graduate MFA status, or in the BA or the MA status, too. I believe those things to be wrong. I always did, as long as I was directly concerned with them.
Hmm. This is somewhat going afar from the school of education itself, but dealing with its influence, I would kind of presume that a lot of the people who are on the faculty of the state colleges, or what used to be the state colleges, are a lot of them graduates of this college?
Yes, unfortunately, far too many of them are all from that same decade of the 50s, because all those schools were growing at just that time.
Of the 60s, you mean?
50s.
The 50s?
Yes.
While you were chairman?
Yes.
And the problem being that...
Well, the problem is, not to say that there aren't some very, very able people in the state university
mm-hmm.
system, there are, but they grew so rapidly, and such a high percentage of them did come here from medicine, that only now, or only, I'd say, in the last 7 or 8 years, have they begun to have more and more younger people of a more diverse background, which I think is very good.
Mm-hmm.
Now that will even be cut off.
Right.
You see, because... Even now, for some years to come, even as some of the older people who are GIs retire, their positions will just not be filled.
Mm-hmm.
My only point about saying it's a little bit too bad is that they all came from a similar background, and they're all of a more or less similar age.
Mm-hmm. Has that made these schools then tend to follow the path that you've seen Madison following in the last 10 or 15 years in terms of the way they treat students, that sort of thing? Are they still, you feel, more upholding of their teaching role?
I think they're more concerned with the teaching role, because they must be. They do not offer the MFA in most cases. They offer only the MA, just the 1 year. And so for the most part, their graduate students are people who are high school teachers or teach in the grades and who are getting a master's degree partly just for the background, partly to increase their salaries.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and also their faculties have not been as permissive in letting them do away with a good deal of the academic requirement.
I see. Well, we've been kind of far afield. Maybe I can draw us back to
to
the early years when you were chairman. You made an interesting comment about the 3 years when you weren't chairman. Around the late 40s and early 50s, you said that some of the faculty that preceded you and your Young Turks were a bit upset with you in some way or another. You made the comment that Annan and Wilson were upset with the Young Turks and so on and so forth. What did you mean by that?
Well, first of all of us were voting members, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And they did feel that we were attempting, they felt, to go too far, too fast. There was also a political circumstance, which I'm reluctant almost to refer to. We did have an extreme right-winger on the faculty. And he assumed that two or three of us were, as he put it, communists.
Mm-hmm.
And he literally did frighten some of the older people into that belief that the department was really facing great dangers. I don't know what the dangers were to be. We hadn't done anything that I remember. It involved specifically some of the men who had been on the WPA art projects. Well, anybody who'd been on the art projects in any of the big cities, in this case it would have been Milwaukee and or Chicago, was bound to have had a lot to do with the various left-wing parties, because they were always having protest marches and so on if any member of Congress tried to shut off the WPA, and all the rest of the things that you only read about in books.
Right.
Well, the faculty member that we had, another faculty member, the one who didn't stay with us indefinitely, who was literally the opposite, an extreme rightist, and literally he got a great sweat up among the elder citizens that the department was in mortal terror, and they believed him,
mm-hmm.
momentarily. And they still had the vote, because so many of them were not. See, the only people who voted were assistant professor.
Oh, I see. So the instructors like Wilde and Greeley and so on and so forth
didn't
have a vote.
Yet. No, not on the chairmanship.
Did that prevent them from rising to, I mean, this balance, was that a reason why they didn't rise to being the assistant professors?
No, because in many cases, for instance, Wilde and Greeley were these people's students.
Mm-hmm.
Though they did not, they were not sympathetic to this point of view, but they couldn't do anything about it because they couldn't vote.
Mm-hmm.
There was a strong anti-Semitism involved in one instance, too, among the older ones.
Mm-hmm.
And we had problems with that, which we only heard of later. People would come into town who were being interviewed for faculty positions, and we never knew they'd been here.
Hmm.
So when they showed up, they turned out to be Jewish.
Hmm.
So the rest of us never saw them or never met them. Well, it's raking over very, very cold coals, but that is, in essence, what happened. I don't mean to say that Mrs. Annan was in the day-to-day operation of the department. She was not, by any means, inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
But on that thing, she was really
mm-hmm.
quite upset.
Mm-hmm. Sort of related to that, maybe related. The art department faculty at the time when you came probably had one of the more one of the better ratios of male to female faculty of any department on the campus at the time, no doubt. No.
Yes, really, because there was Miss Wilson and Mrs. Annan and the actual faculty and Ruth Alcott over in Wisconsin High School.
Uh-huh. Did this, you know, the male-female balance there, did that ever create issues as a result of that fact alone? Did that ever come up as a problem in relationships?
No, it did not. Now, strangely enough, the two older women, Miss Wilson and Mrs. Annan, never, never wanted to hire a woman.
They were explicit about that.
Well, they never approved of any woman candidate that came.
Even if some of the other faculty were approving?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
There was a painter one time that we got from North Dakota. Wonderful, looking person. We didn't have money enough to bring her. She was so far away, but we couldn't hire her because they didn't want her.
Were you ever able to discern why that was, or?
I assume they didn't want any other women. They enjoyed their position, as it were. Now, I will say that there were a number of women candidates that we did have, and I don't count myself as being a person who was far out in these matters, but I felt that we should hire women. And in several instances where I would insist on hanging on to a woman into the period where we had, say, three to choose from, they were never taken. The faculty finally voted against them and has only done so very recently. The only one that has been in the department any length of time, of course, has been Professor Krylik. Now, she came because she was in with a group of people who were more or less all together and who'd all taught at Cranbrook together.
Cranbrook is in Michigan. Is that where it's?
Well, they had gone to Cranbrook and they had taught at Toledo Museum. That included Ernie Mole, Marge Krylik, Harvey Littleton. Excuse me, there's one other. That came. Those three, though, all had taught with each other in that place, in the Toledo Museum, the School of the Toledo Museum.
Where is Cranbrook?
Cranbrook is outside of Detroit.
Okay, that's fine.
So that was the only woman we ever hired. Until recently. So we have a long way to go before we're anywhere near balance.
Mm-hmm. Yet, well, most of your students, I presume, are a majority were females. Is that correct?
It's always been true, yes. I'm sure it's always been true. Mm-hmm. It has varied vastly. Perhaps not during the GI period. The full flush of the GI period, probably not true. But after, say, 1950, I would say it probably has been true.
Right. Let me ask you about a couple of more specific things that happened in the early or late 40s, and perhaps you can go from there. One thing that apparently was done in 1948 was that there was a curriculum committee put together, and there was a relatively major revision of the art curriculum, mm-hmm. the art requirements and stuff of that sort. Can you elaborate, you know, why did that happen then, and what were the causes that led to that? And
yeah.
Who was pushing for that kind of thing?
I was, and the reason for it was evident. We needed to do it. I had begun to do it in Milwaukee State Teachers, but didn't stay long enough to do it. All these schools had been operating pretty largely on curricula that had been pretty much the same way from, say, the middle 20s at least up to the present, up to that time. Mm-hmm. And then besides that, there had been an absolutely complete chaos when it comes to interpreting the curriculum. For instance, Art Survey was supposed to be a freshman class.
Mm-hmm.
Students didn't particularly like the course. Mr. Barnum taught it. I can understand why it was difficult for them to like it, because it was the kind of course that I've taught most of the years after I came up here. And he taught it in a great big room that had big echoing ceilings, and he had a screen that was this big. It
about
was an old screen.
2 feet by 2 feet.
Just about. It was an old screen made of silk. It was so old that it was yellow. And to make matters worse, it was a back projection. You know what that means?
Yes.
The machine is back here.
The screen is in between the machine and the audience.
Right. And so he would have up to 70 students in that room. And they didn't even have decent dark shades. They just had ordinary pull-down shades. Well, then besides that, he had slides that were, he must have made most of those slides in the period before 1920. Hadn't kept them up to date at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up, I got a screen that was about 9 feet square, pure white granulated surface, which we pulled tight like a canvas with grommets all over,
mm-hmm.
and got a huge new projector for those days and blew up these great big screens. But the big thing was we made a curriculum which was freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, and we made people take them as those courses.
Mm-hmm.
We had seniors taking art survey and finishing freshman drawing in 46, 47.
Nice.
They just came around as the, you know, they wanted to take portrait painting with Stebbins first in the, as freshmen. Nobody paid any attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we just simply made a curriculum that led from year to year. You didn't take this until you'd done that.
Well, it sounds like the way of the curriculum running before you came along was a lot like the way your art course in high school ran with
just
Rebecca
about.
Chase.
Sure, just any old thing, whatever you, the spirit moved. And people came and went at great liberty, and it seemed perfectly evident to me that we needed to do something very badly.
Mm-hmm. Did you, in addition to insisting on the structure and of the sequence, did you add courses or delete courses, or was there any major change there?
I suppose there was some. I think what we did was the kind of thing that had become quite common, and it still remains fairly common, to make a practically precise freshman and sophomore sequence. And then you strike out into more elective patterns for the junior and senior year.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere in there, art history is fitted with
they
an expanded
They had never
role.
Required art history.
Mm-hmm.
Here they had one of the first art history courses in the United States, at least east of the Appalachians.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the really great art historians, Oscar Hagen, and art history wasn't a required subject at all.
Mm. So that was a major change.
Six credits in art history were required. Still do, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, that, you see, I didn't do anything about that in 46-7 because I was just serving as a backup for Della. But in 47-48 we began on that curriculum, and it really was no great shakes. We just simply made a quite strict pattern for freshman sophomore years,
mm-hmm.
and then two or three or four options with choices that could be made in the junior senior year depending on whether you wanted to emphasize, let's say, three-dimensional crafts or painting, drawing, or whether you were in art education or just in applied arts or whatever it might be, so that there was quite a liberal scattering across the whole department possible. Essentially, that's the way most art programs are in colleges today.
I'll get to that later. A couple of years after that, you had a committee that dealt with the problem of the teaching load. In 1951, there was a committee. Some of the members, Greeley, Sessler, and Wilde, were on this committee,
mm-hmm.
dealing with the problem of teaching load. I presume that you must have had a rather tremendous problem with teaching load much sooner than that, even in 1946-47.
Well, we did, because we really just didn't have any guidelines whatever, and so it was very... we had gradually gotten down to the point where what we felt was ideal at that time would be two undergraduate courses, which would be 6 hours a week for each class,
mm-hmm.
in studio, and at least one of what we called upper echelon class. That would have been a junior-senior kind of class, and that has remained pretty much the case ever since. Now, for a while, not long after Harvey Littleton became chairman, they went in for having everybody had two studio classes. That would be about 12 hours of studio presence, and one seminar. The idea being that you would be, let's say, take graphic arts with Colescott, and he would have a beginning graphic arts and an advanced and graduate graphic arts, and then he would have a seminar for graphic arts. Well, they did that for 2 or 3 years, and that didn't work out very well.
This was in the late 50s?
This came much later, in the 70s, early 70s. And they've largely abandoned that now. They've gone back to two 6-hour classes, largely for undergraduates. And then various kinds of independent or classroom activities for graduate students as the third part of the load.
Now, the reason that they did this, was that a matter of simply there wasn't any rule about it, or was it a matter that there was rather unequal distribution of load?
There was quite an unequal distribution of the load, and it had just grown up without any particular positive direction. As a matter of fact, we overloaded the graduate students who were taking their degree and taking one or two classes. Well, for them to take two classes was far more than they should have had. So it really came down to this kind of thing that is pretty much general throughout the country, with the exception of somebody like Wilde. Now, Wilde has this name professorship. They've named it the Alfred Sessler Professorship, so that he only has two classes a week instead of three.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, he has his summer sessions on his own. But see, Wilde is really the only member of the department who is nationally known for his painting. He's very quiet about it all, but he is represented in more national collections and national exhibits than anybody else in the group.
Hmm. Aaron Bowrod is not formally a member of the department.
He has never been a teacher in the department.
Okay.
See, he was only in the College of Agriculture. Well, that happened because Dean Christensen in the late 30s was one of these great Scandinavian educators who believed that there should be a far greater interest in the quality of life in the agricultural college than rather just the techniques and the mechanics of farming.
Mm-hmm.
So he set up a resident artist in residence in the College of Agriculture. Well, successive deans after that couldn't have cared less. They kept carrying Aaron as long as Aaron was around because he'd built up quite a publicity on it, but they, as you noticed, did nothing about it after he retired. Because Dean Pound couldn't. Dean Pound is strictly an agribusiness type.
Mm-hmm.
Quality of life doesn't mean a thing to him. Quality of life means how much money in the bank. So that episode was strictly because of Christensen.
Uh-huh. Well, we've been talking about this quite a while. There are other things, but maybe we can leave that for maybe one last time. Right now, I think I'd like you to elaborate more on your experience in England, this Birmingham business
yeah.
as you were talking about.
All right. Well, the Manuel Barkin was one of my close associates in the art education in the United States. He was at Ohio State. All right, so we're going. He had wanted for a long time to go to Europe and do some studying abroad, and in one way or another he'd gotten in touch with the School for the Training of Teachers of Art in Birmingham. And they had asked him to come. They'd be glad to have him visit, but could he teach for a year? Well, he couldn't. He felt that he could visit for perhaps 3 months between October and Christmas. But they wanted to have a full year's teacher. So he wrote me and asked if I would be agreeable and available to teach from Christmas time to about the middle of July, which is a British second and third term. Mm-hmm. And of course that seemed like a very good idea to me, so he went ahead and taught with them from September through Christmas holiday. And then we got over there and taught. I taught from early January until early July, with a 2 weeks holiday, which in March sometime, which we managed to take in Athens, so that made a very nice diversion. Mm-hmm. But it was an interesting experience, and interestingly enough, after that time, about 2 years later, we made an arrangement whereby Gibson Bird traded with Eric Forrest, who was one of the Birmingham people, and Eric and Gib traded houses and cars. So Eric was here for a year, and Gib was over there for a year. Unfortunately for Gib, Eric's car was a beat-up old station wagon with the boards falling off on either side, and he had his problems with that. But that proved to be a very good arrangement, and then subsequently we had Eric come over here permanently, and he took over the headship of the new art department at Parkside. Hmm. Since that time, he has left there about 2 years ago, and he's now head of the art department in Ohio University in Athens. And then also, we have had John Marlowe, who is one of my associates in Birmingham, come over, and he has stayed in the States as well. So I didn't do very well by Birmingham. He carted away two of their best teachers, and they've stayed here in the States.
Now, this was your trip there was in which year?
I was there in 64. Okay. Yeah. No, 65. It was the academic year 64-5. Okay. I was there in 65. And it was interesting to compare the thing that they do with what we do. They, for instance, this was the School for Training Teachers of Art. Mm-hmm. Nice, short, jazzy little name. At that time, more or less independent. It was conducted in a house, an old brick house that had been built about 1780, and had a great big garden out in back in Edgbaston, which is a very, very plushy part of Birmingham. And the way in which they work teacher training in England is quite interesting. You first go to college, art college in this case, and you get a degree. With an art degree, you can teach school. You need have no background whatsoever in teacher preparation. But you teach at a very low level of salary. Mm-hmm. If you want to become the classification of teacher, and I can't remember the name, you must apply for a year of teacher training. And you get a stipend to go to school if you are accepted. Mm-hmm. So you send in your papers. It's like a year of graduate work. Mm-hmm. And we had each year to go over all those papers and to accept or reject the people whom we would take on for teacher training. They then spent the whole year with us in this old red brick house, doing practice teaching, having seminars and studying the background, history, development, present practices of art education, and doing some studio work. That is, they could make a choice between three-dimensional work, which Marlowe conducted, or graphic arts, which Eric Forrest did, or painting. They couldn't do all three, but they could do one of these things. So that you really had an older group of people, and all of them had taught at least a year or two. It was cold, bitter cold, in the house, and it never warmed up until June. We had faculty meetings. We met at 10 o'clock coffee and met at least an hour every morning in the week. when we would just jaw about who the students were and what we thought about this one or that. It was just a big bull session, is what it amounted to. It's a most curious experience compared with our rather rigidly organized time patterns.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned that a couple of the faculty from Birmingham have come over here.
Mm-hmm.
Has this established any sort of long-term program, or was this in some way a pioneering effort, or did you just sort of fall into it?
I guess it was, in a way, a pioneering effort. I suppose that a good many English people get to the East Coast without much problem.
Mm-hmm.
Take a New York trip, or New York, or Boston, or Washington, or something, but actually it has proven to be this little group, Manchester. For instance, one of my students who wrote his paper with me is now head of that school. He's
Which
now
school?
The Birmingham school. He's head or president of the British Association of Art Education. He has come over here and visited broadly through the states. He has written some articles for our American National Art Education Journal. We've had another of his staff members, Mike Stavaney, over here. Mike has written a book or so for British art education, so that actually the group that we dealt with, the Wisconsin people dealt with, is very high on the totem pole in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And they maintain some very considerable links with American art education in general, which is quite pleasing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to say that we pushed them into this. They simply have been the kind of people who did that.
Mm-hmm.
Followed up on it. All right, then we'll go right to that institute.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and you can talk about the art institutes.
Yeah. Well, there was this problem through the 50s of people wanting to finish a master's degree and get the greater background for themselves in many cases, and also, of course, there's the salary increment that in what most of the schools gave them for having a master's degree.
Just a minute. I'm going to look for something.
Okay, going back to the institutes.
Yeah. Well, these people did want to finish off their degrees. Now, since that time, a great many people did stay on and finish their degree by staying another year.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think now that is over and we're beginning to get more of the other sort of thing. People can't afford to stay much beyond the bachelor's degree. They go out and teach if they get a job and then come back in summer sessions. At any rate, that was the situation in the 50s. Well, in order to have something a little special other than just simply classroom, we thought it would be well to try to get as many visitors as we could, and because a lot of these people simply did not or could not go to New York or see some of the outstanding people. So what we tried to do every year was to get, or every summer, was to get an outstanding person in the arts and then somebody who was quite outstanding in art education, because most of them had both interests in their minds. Well, for instance, we got old people like Ben Shawn in the arts, and we got Victor D'Amico from the Museum of Modern Art in art education, and then we got Thomas Monroe from Cleveland Museum one summer, and Charlie Eames, who just died recently, in design and industrial design. He was a very good visitor. And I'm trying to think, the man who was at Black Mountain College for so many years. He and his wife both came.
Let's pick up right away.
Oh, right. Well, Albers was at Black Mountain. He came from there to be with us for a week, 10 days. And later on, Black Mountain closed, and Albers went to Yale, and I think he stayed with the Yale faculty most of his life from then on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was very good, and he did things his own way. He staked out a table out on the Rathskeller Terrace, the outside terrace, big round table.
Mm-hmm.
And there he sat from 8:30 in the morning till 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
And he just said he didn't really want to visit classes. He'd seen enough classes. But he'd be glad to have any student who wanted to visit with him.
Mm-hmm.
So all day long, from morning till night, he had people sitting all around that table, 8 or 10 of them.
Uh-huh.
At times there would be as many again standing in a row beyond, and he would just be talking all the time. And not preaching, but they'd ask him a question, he'd talk. He was really a great visitor in that respect.
Sounds rather Socratic.
Very much so, very much so. Now, Buckminster Fuller, we had Fuller for 4 days, and that was simply incredible. I don't suppose you've ever seen him.
I've never seen him. I'm mm-hmm. quite aware of him. I was in Southern Illinois one time and aware of his presence.
Well, he came in. We usually started them with an evening lecture in the theater at the Union. And he came in with 4 boxes like these that I've just gotten out. 4 boxes of slides tied together with an old piece of laundry rope.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, Mr. Fuller, which slides do you want us to use this evening? Well, he said, we'll start at the top and go as far as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, this is not going to be good, you know, this will be dreary. So he was still talking from 8, still talking at 10:30, 10:45. People at the Union Theater came and whispered to me that they had to close the place at 11 o'clock. Well, at that time we had an old lecture room in the old yellow brick buildings that were where the Helen C. White Library is now.
Mm-hmm.
That was our main lecture room. And so I interrupted him, which wasn't easy. Never is with Bucky. And told the audience that anyone who would like to stay with it a little longer, we would open up again at 11:15 in the lecture room up there in the hill. And I thought, well, that'll be that. You see, we'll get up there and I'll ask for a few questions and Bucky will have to talk. But I won't let him have the slides and we'll quit pretty soon. Nothing of the sort. He insisted on having the slides, and we didn't leave that room until 1:30 that night. Well, then he was there for 4 days, and I simply couldn't get anything else done. I had to run from room to room, starting at 8 in the morning, closing often at 5 at night, trying to find out where I would put Bucky and his little group for the next period. He'd start, I'd say, don't you need a rest? Let's go down and have coffee, meet some of the faculty. No, we're coming somewhere, we're getting somewhere. Off we'd go to another room. After that, another room. I could only make him take a half hour lunch. And this went on, I think, for 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
And that's the way the man has always been.
His energy's rather legendary.
Just talks. Endlessly. I remember later, about 10 years later, he was to appear at Milwaukee, UWM, in what was then one of their very new buildings, and they started at 8:30, and they were going to have cookies and punch at 10. And I asked the faculty member who had that in charge what they were going to have, and she told me it involved ice cream or ices.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I hope you have a good freezer. She said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you won't be ready to use it until at least 1 a.m. And she looked at me and laughed and laughed. I said, well, honestly, put it away, because you won't be ready until 1, and even then he will have to be stopped. And she didn't believe it, and her ice simply melted, because she got it all ready for about 11:30, and he was going still at 1:30 a.m. Well, we had curious experiences of that sort all the time.
I gather the students, though, liked it.
Very much so. I still talk to teachers around the state who remember exactly the people who visited each summer.
Mm-hmm.
If they were with us 3 or 4 summers, they'll know just who they were. Well, one of the things is we were quite early in doing this. We found that we would ask some of these people to come back 3 or 4 years later. And by that time, it had become so established a thing in American universities. And these people had become so well known that we simply couldn't get the money together.
Now, your first one was in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We tried to get Buckminster Fuller once again, and we just couldn't afford it. I think we needed $3,000 or $4,000. And he wrote a very nice personal letter, said that he'd enjoyed being with us the first time, that indeed we'd been one of the first 2 or 3 that got him started on this, but
mm-hmm.
he said what with the kinds of projects he had in mind now, he was just charging a very flat and very high fee, because if people didn't want to pay it, he didn't want to interrupt what he was doing
right.
that much.
Mm-hmm.
So we did get in on it at a time when we got some very nationally known people.
Right. I think you were mentioning earlier something about the students and the GIs and stuff. Did we talk about that?
Well, yes.
Why in 52? That is, you know, why didn't you begin this right after the war, or who isn't behind getting this going and that sort of thing?
Well, we didn't really begin it only in 52. We had had visitors. What they had been doing in the period of the war years, late 40s, had been to get a visitor for six weeks, just
mm-hmm.
a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the time we were into the 50s, the GI enrollment was falling off to some extent, and our faculty wasn't getting paid big salaries, and many of them hoped each year to teach summer school. On the other hand, we felt that it was valuable to have some of these people come, such as we had had teach.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of having just a person come and teach for the 6 weeks, we'd have the regular staff do all the teaching. And then we went to this other thing of having one person who was a practitioner of the arts, another person who was working in art education for a week. Now, they didn't teach courses.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't responsible for grading. They weren't responsible for any of that. But in many ways, it was more satisfactory, because the visitor who's with you to teach just a 6-week session, sometimes they were superb teachers, sometimes they couldn't have cared less. It's too brief.
Mm-hmm.
Then another disadvantage of it is that you could never carry over. If you're getting a degree only in summer, you like to start work, let's say, in prints with this person in print,
right.
who will be there next summer,
right.
and the summer following. And the visitors, we couldn't do that with them. So that was one of the reasons we went to the Institute kind of presentation.
Now, you mentioned that the Institutes continue, but not in the same form as they originally began. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Well, in a way, I haven't been very close to summer sessions for many years now.
Mm-hmm.
See, Really, I haven't very often taught since the year I went to England, and that was way back in the 60s. I think we don't have as many people getting consistently year after year, 4 or 5 summers, getting a degree.
Mm-hmm.
More and more people don't do that. They will get a bachelor's degree, then they will try to squeeze out another full year for the degree. In those years, we still had a lot of people who had been accustomed to the 30s. We had our advisor activities keyed to them. That is, we'd have a folder for them. When they came back the second summer, we'd have the folder with their record of what they'd done the summer before. They'd have the same advisor, mm-hmm. and they'd go on for the 4 or 5 or 6 summers.
Right.
I don't think we pay as much attention to those things anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If a person does get a degree over the summer sessions, they're pretty much left on their own to do their own advisement,
mm-hmm.
plan their own coursework, and so on. It isn't as a... We just had a more regular student body, I think, coming. As one group would leave each summer, there would be others filling in.
Mm-hmm.
And you had their records, and they expected to go right on through.
Okay. When you went, let's see, somewhere back in the 50s, maybe later, there is the matter of the internship, I guess it was the late 50s,
yes.
internships
uh-huh.
and teaching.
Uh-huh.
And there was a debate, I think, about whether to block or to intern in terms of
Mm-hmm.
in general in the School of Education.
Yes.
How did that relate to the art department, and what were some of the discussions that went on in the art department concerning art and art education, concerning that particular issue?
Well, first of all, that whole idea of the internship came about with sizable help from the Ford Foundation, as you probably
mm-hmm.
know. So John Guy had worked that out, John Guy Fawkes with others had worked that out. The whole idea was, as far as the intern was concerned, is that we would look for and try to enroll people from our own university and other universities who had already completed a BA degree or its equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And we would encourage them to come to Madison to do a different and a more intensive kind of teacher preparation over a 1-year period.
Mm-hmm.
They would take a semester of work in teacher preparation kinds of courses. Then they would literally become a kind of part-time staff member in a school. The school would pay them.
Mm-hmm.
And the university had some money from Ford to hire the time of more of our people so that we could supervise at some distance from Madison and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
No, at its best it worked out very well. The problem was that it was a very hard thing to administer. And if you had a truly interested superintendent at schools, a person who liked the idea of seeing what he could do this way,
mm-hmm.
well, you'd get along very well. In many cases, the superintendents felt that they owed something to the University School of Education or to John Guy Fawkes personally,
mm-hmm.
or to some of us with whom they worked in the special areas, art education or math education or science or whatever it might be. And they would say, well, yes, they weren't too sure how they thought about it, but they would be willing to try it out. In some cases, smaller town superintendents literally looked upon it as some cheap labor.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the problems, and rather an important problem, because they would not really fill out their faculty members. They'd say, well, we'll get a couple or 3 or 4 of these interns from the university to take up the slack, and That would be cheap.
Was this a problem from the beginning, that sort of thing, or did this develop later?
Well, I don't know how quickly we became aware of it. You weren't really sure, because when first you start something like that, mm-hmm. all of the superintendents, of course, had been told that this is not a cheapy program, that wasn't its intention, and that you wanted really to have unusually qualified students who would be looking for an unusually thorough and unusual kind of teacher preparation student mm-hmm. teaching. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be student teaching, it would be apprenticeship teaching. Well, theoretically, we were to get outstanding teachers in a really good school situation with sympathetic principals and sympathetic superintendents. Well, that means you have to have the teacher with whom your young teacher works, the principal, the superintendent, the person in the university who's responsible for any one of the given programs. Everybody has to be convinced, first of all. And then all of those people have to really want to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, of course, humanly impossible to find any single place where all of the factors were as favorable as one might hope.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get a place, and I can think of several, where the art program was very good, the principal was fine, you get a good student going out there, and the principal, however, would really be looking upon it as a cheap labor.
Can you mention towns, or would you rather not?
No, I'd better not.
Okay.
But if there was one person who was looking at it not as something of a challenge educationally, it weakened that particular assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't as easy to find those people as you might think.
Mm-hmm.
What we were thinking to do was that we would recruit these people from all over the Middle West and the East and every other place. Well, we did. We did get a lot of very good people. But we would run into funny little quirks. For instance, we got half a dozen people that I can think of. I could look them up and find their names, but I shouldn't and I wouldn't, who came from unusually good letters and science colleges.
Mm-hmm.
They had perhaps two-thirds as much artwork as our students had, but they had a very good academic record, and they were very much interested. They would get into school, do their teaching. Then that would have been one semester. What to do next? Well, I would say, why don't you apply for status as a master's degree student? You've got your BA from your home college, undergraduate major in art.
Mm-hmm.
You've done the student teaching. Apply for master's degree, you'll probably have to do some undergraduate work for at least a semester because you didn't have enough art in your mm-hmm. smaller college. They get into the art department, and that's the last you see of them as teachers.
They just go right on then.
Become so much interested in what you see they hadn't had in their smaller college.
Mm-hmm.
Here's this big department, technically infinitely ahead of what they'd found available. Well, now, some of those people have continued, have gone back into college teaching or into high school teaching, and they're excellent. Some never did.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you expect that kind of change of position. How many undergraduates have stayed with the thing they've done in college?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, they just don't do it until they get to, say, the professional schools like law or medicine or something.
Now, I presume that before that, the common means of a person getting certification to teach was through the block approach, or the shorter sort of non-paid approach to the instruction.
Well, now that's one thing that did happen with the internship. Actually, the present arrangement of teaching on the block semester would not perhaps have come into being, at least for the art department, if we hadn't had the internship.
Mm-hmm.
Because we used to satisfy ourselves with 5 weeks in an elementary school and 5 weeks in a secondary school and let it go at that. Now they get a much better experience because, well, we literally just do say if you're getting your teaching certification, it's going to take you a semester working in the schools with no other credit than that.
Mm-hmm. So you've made it, as a result of the internship program, rather equivalent in experience.
Very similar, mm-hmm. But without the pay.
Yeah.
So that they, they have to be closer in, nor are they required to be as responsible.
Mm-hmm. What has been the feedback of students over the years in regard to the two types of programs?
Well, first of all, the student who comes today and goes through this quite extensive block semester has nothing to compare it with.
Mm-hmm.
I have something to compare it with. Mm-hmm. That is, when first I came, we could and did send a student out to teach, say, 3 afternoons a week in one semester in a grade school. The student would take 5 credits of practice teaching. Then they would fill their program up to 14 to 16 credits with some teacher training coursework and then other art courses, whatever they could get in. Next semester they'd go to a high school because, you see, the art people have to have some experience in the art, in the high school and some in the grade school. Well, now that isn't anything near as good as their present experience
mm-hmm.
in teacher training, in actual practice teaching.
Right.
It takes some more time, it's harder work, but they've come closer to the real thing of teaching
right.
than they used to.
How has the faculty felt about the block program as compared to the internship program? That is, I presume that not all the faculty were willing to do internship type work when it first began, that kind of thing.
Well, not very many. We never have a whole lot of faculty people who are responsible for that, you see.
Mm-hmm.
The department, how many have we now? Close to 40, I guess. There are 3 full-time people in art education. We've never had more than 3 or 4, with some people part-time. So that whatever we do in the way of teacher preparation is just a matter of agreement among those 3 or 4 people.
Mm-hmm.
True, the rest of the faculty will vote, always votes on any change. And when we went to the block semester, somebody said, well, this is going to mean that some students will have to spend an extra semester at school. You'll find that they drop out. Well, they don't have to spend another semester. If they plan closely, they can make it in 8 semesters.
Mm-hmm.
Most students don't like to plan that closely. If we have had students drop out, and I'm sure we have, I can't remember a time when a superior student dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
More than likely it was somebody who was there because somebody at home said, well, you ought to get your teaching certificate.
Mm-hmm.
They really didn't want it. So they would build it up in their parents' eyes that this was a great burden. I'm just guessing.
Right.
I'm not aware of our having lost any superior students.
Mm-hmm. Did the internship program and that sort of, you know, it's obviously a more complicated arrangement than the sort of arrangement that you described earlier when you would call up Phil Falk or something and arrange. Was this part of the impact on what you described as sort of the widening gap of cooperation, so to speak, between the school systems and the university?
Well,
I mean, was this?
It may have been simply because, again, it would get called for more red tape, more paperwork, more visiting. And not visiting, now I don't think we ever complain about visiting if it's visiting a student in a classroom. That's the best kind of visiting there is. Mm-hmm. The more we could do of that, the better. But the paperwork and the negotiating with principals, with superintendents, with the teachers, that kind of thing can wear you out and waste a great deal of time.
In the internship program, the teacher under who the student is placed, are they remunerated in any way for that?
They did get some money. It wasn't really enough. And then another thing about it was that there was no way in which you had time enough with those teachers. We should have had time enough with those teachers to be able to spend, even to ask them to come into the university, let's say once a month, and meet together, with their expenses being paid, or with them to have a half day off to do it, and say, now, these are the things we want to do. One of the hardest things that is always present in any teacher training activity is to get the teacher who is working with the young person to take enough responsibility. They simply don't like to say to the student, look, you haven't reached those children very well.
Mm-hmm.
Or you don't speak well enough. Or you aren't watchful about this or that. They think that is all to be done by the university staff in visiting. There are very few teachers that with whom you can place a university student, even to this day, who just flatly take it upon themselves to instruct this person in just some of the ordinary things that a teacher knows. It's always been hard to get a teacher to do that. They seem to think, first, it's the university advisor's job to do it, and secondly, the student will resent it. And neither one of them is necessarily true. Once in a while, you get a teacher who will. See, it would be so much better if the teachers had the desire to do it and weren't fearful.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that that's, partly related to the structuring of the situation? That is, teachers are professionals, at least supposedly professional. If they're professional, and if this was a professional service, which it is, then they would be paid in appropriate way for it, and then they would understand what the situation was about.
Possibly, if we could pay them enough to make it worth their while. I do think the teachers' union has not been helpful in that way. I don't like teachers' unions myself. Because while I have no objection to their efforts to raise the level of teacher salaries to equivalency of other professionals, which I think is entirely correct, I just don't think that teaching should be done on a stopwatch basis.
Mm-hmm.
If I were teaching in the junior high that I started in Milwaukee, the union would have me up on the carpet scolding me for spending too much time. No, I just don't think that's any union's business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a teacher is a professional person. They want to spend some extra time, feel that it's justified and that they have it to spend, that's their business. And to have a union treat teaching as if it's a big factory where you blow the whistle and all the machines stop.
Mm-hmm.
To my mind, that's a dreadful situation.
Okay, we were going to discuss this 10-year study that was done in 1956.
The faculty committee, I'm sure, had the idea in mind that there were a number of bases on which the department was not as far up the ladder as it ought to be. One of those was physical. We had we had gone about as far as we could go in the old buildings. By that time, John Guy Fawkes had pretty well managed to occupy the old School of Education pretty thoroughly. We had acceptable studios on the very top floor that had originally been built as drafting rooms for the College of Engineering, so that they were not at all bad as rooms for such things as general drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And painting classes such as watercolor, where one didn't use enormous materials. We didn't have, by any means, excellent resources for such things as serigraphy. Meeker was one of the people who felt that we needed, and he was right about it, we needed much better equipment for serigraphy. And then the next thing that we needed, and the report was quite strong on this, we needed to have more space for graduate work. That is to say, as an example, our ceramic area was a good one, had good kill room, good space, but you had to teach large undergraduate classes and a good many of them in the same space that then the graduate students had to work in, and it was very difficult for graduate students to work on larger and more numerous projects in the same room, which would be occupied by undergraduate classes that were bigger in the numbers of people. There was a storage problem in everything. So space was one of the things we really needed desperately to get one way and another. The salary problem was somewhat modified over what it had been 10 years before, but we were still clearly lower person for person, year for year in experience than any other group in the School of Education. Now, that was partly because in the university prior to, we'll say, the beginning of World War II, all departments that did not have the traditional doctoral degrees were not paid as well as those departments that did have them.
In other words, art, phy-ed were not paid as well.
And music. Well, as an example, a woman by the name of Johnson, and I can't remember her name, but not too long ago in 68 when we were doing a history of the fine arts departments in the university, came upon the fact that this Miss Johnson had been a superb director of drama,
mm-hmm.
recognized by many of her students who had gone on into the movies, some of them into Broadway productions, as a really inspiring director. But she had only a master's degree, and she was a woman. She was never even voted full professor. The majority of our faculty, of the faculty prior to 46, was female. None of the faculty had a doctoral. And so it had been a low-paid department. And comparatively speaking, it remained so in 56. Now, part of that was the lack of a doctorate and the continued emphasis on that in the university in general. And part of it was sheer age, because a great many of the people who had been added to the department from 46 through the early 50s were quite young. Had just finished their master's degree or master of fine arts, with their GI Bill in many cases after they had gotten out of the Army. So we did have both of those problems. I think the department, probably this very day, is still not quite, it may be up to the average of the university, but it is a better than a far better than average art department, and it isn't paid in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's a long, slow pull when a department starts out at a very low level. Now, part of the report, the idea of inadequacy of space, was modified to a certain extent when we moved into the present humanities building. But now we are again facing the same thing. We don't have enough of the separate facilities for the graduate student and the undergraduate.
Now, is that true even though enrollment in the school of education seems to be declining as a whole?
Well, if the enrollment does go on a gradual decline, part of it is how many undergraduate classes have to run through a given studio in the course of a week.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take printmaking now. You'll say there's the woodcut studio. Mr. Grackler usually runs it. Well, if he has three or four classes, and that's 6 hours a week, it isn't 3 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
If you had four classes then, you've got 24 hours of occupancy by a relatively large undergraduate group. When is a graduate student going to embark on longer time projects?
Mm-hmm.
And where is he going to keep his stuff while he's working?
Right.
See, that's the problem.
Right.
It isn't that graduate student needs all kinds of work or of room, but he needs more place to keep his stuff while his work is in progress, his or her work, because there's just as many women, if not more. And storage is a problem. The graduate student needs storage areas so that he can keep his stuff. It isn't like, we'll say, a history class, where if the room is empty, okay. That is a problem of materials as well as hours of occupancy. So again, that problem is it's always with every art department.
Mm-hmm.
And it had reached something of a crisis in 56, and already we were beginning to look forward to the fact that the next building, a major building project in 56, was already known to be art, music, and history.
Mm-hmm. Now, just taking a bit of a tangent to this, in 1955 and 56, you were on the Capital Needs Committee of the School of Education, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Now, that must have been one of the things that you were dealing with on that. Is that correct?
Probably, although the place where I would have been dealing with it more directly would have been on the Campus Planning Committee.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was on the Campus Planning Committee with people from journalism, from drama, music, history. In a way, the Campus Planning Committee is usually a kind of a grouping of people who are most needy.
Now that was in the early 60s, that your membership on that committee.
Well, no, I was in there quite a long time. Early 60s I was certainly on, and that's when we began to have this stacking of the membership,
mm-hmm,
into those departments which were later represented in the Communication Arts Building and in the Humanities Building.
In other words, you're saying that the Capital Needs Committee of the School of Education was sort of a shopping list committee, but without a lot of influence, as opposed to the Campus Planning Committee.
Well, the Capital Needs Committee, I suspect, did not deal with building as such, but rather with such things as equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the art department always is needing equipment. It's, mm-hmm, it's an eternal. We were one of the biggest customers of GI goods that were being dispersed from Truax Field for many years.
Mm-hmm.
because our faculty would always go out there and shop around and see what they could find, you know, in the way of buckets, pails, vessels of all sorts, printing presses, anything they could find, and we were always ordering stuff from the Truax Field Storage Depot.
When did that finally close up?
Well, I don't really remember. I know that we certainly were the major department in getting that kind of material.
Okay.
In fact, we would usually run out of our capital goods budget by, say, January or February. And then John Guy would say, well, hold off until March or April or so, and then all these other departments who never buy anything but paper and erasers, I'll give you their capital budget, which is what we usually did.
Okay. I think that just a couple other things I'd like to ask you, dealing with the art and art education department. One thing would be if you could discuss how the MFA program, Master of Fine Arts program, came about. That is, where was the push for this and the models that you used to put it together and so on and so forth. And perhaps in with that, throw a discussion about, you know, the doctorate versus you know, the MFA controversy, which you've written articles about and so on.
Well, the art department had the only terminal degree the art department was permitted to give at that time was the MS in art.
Now, this is when you first came, in the 40s.
And indeed, that was the case in almost all American universities. There's a bird. And they, there was no other degree in most American universities. Whether in our university, the MS, rather than the MA, suggested a technical degree. That's why the somewhat curious Masters of Science in Art, because it was not a liberal arts degree. And I don't know where the MFA started, somewhere in the East Coast, Master of Fine Arts, as in some schools, Master of Fine Arts was 1 year master's degree. It was just, the differentiation was the MA was for liberal arts, which could apply to art history. And then the Master of Fine Arts was to differentiate the studio kind of master's degree from the MA degree. However, there was another degree that was taking hold in many of the more eastern colleges, and which we felt very strongly we ought to go toward. And that was the idea of a minimum 2 year beyond the baccalaureate, 2 year degree in essentially studio work with concomitant work in art history and with some work in seminar.